Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. 10 million tweets, 116,000 Instagram posts, and 61,500 Facebook posts. They were all part of a Russian-led misinformation campaign in the lead-up to the 2016 presidential election. On Monday, the Senate Intelligence Committee released two reports that shed new light on how broad this campaign was and who it targeted. The independent reports, commissioned by the Senate Intelligence Committee, analyzed tens of thousands of social media posts coordinated by the Internet Research Agency, a St. Petersburg-based group with connections to the Kremlin. Sound familiar? That's because back in February, Robert Mueller's office indicted a dozen employees of the Internet Research Agency and a Russian oligarch who contributed funding to the organization. Here's Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein at a press conference.
The defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare against the United States, with the stated goal of spreading distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general.
At the center of these new reports were also specific attempts by the Internet Research Agency to target African Americans and persuade them not to vote for Hillary Clinton. The report also faults tech companies like Facebook and Google for not sharing enough data to get closer to that answer. The findings are dramatic. Joining me now to help me unpack the latest reports are Craig Timberg, a national technology reporter for The Washington Post, and Darren Linville, an associate professor at the Clemson University College of Behavioral, Social, and Health Sciences. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
Hello.
So, Craig, let's start with you. These reports are accusing companies like Google and Facebook of holding back information in this investigation. What can you tell us about this? I mean, they claim that they were cooperative. Obviously, this report says otherwise. What's really happening here, Craig?
The tech companies have come under fire now for more than 2 years for how they've handled this crisis. Virtually every lawmaker on Capitol Hill has been frustrated by the response from the companies. And now, you know, these two groups of very well-respected researchers have separately come to the conclusion that as much as we've learned this week from these reports, we would have learned a lot more had Facebook and Google and Twitter been more forthcoming in what they shared with the committee. And Google comes into for some particular criticism with how it gave information on YouTube where they submitted the videos, but none of the information around the videos. And Facebook withheld quite a few posts, all of the comments. So these researchers are echoing complaints we've heard for a couple years now.
Now, if they had been provided the data, Craig, that they say that they hadn't gotten, would the researchers have been able to determine how much these efforts actually influenced the election?
That was not a question that they or really anybody else I can think of has attempted to answer, because on a scientific level, it's not answerable. In order to get that answer, you'd have to run the election again, and you'd have to somehow, you know, remove one factor, which is the Russian disinformation campaign. So the efforts of these groups have been essentially what every researcher in the world who studied this have done. It's a forensic unpacking of what happened, an attempt to make sense of tactics and motives. And what we can say without the fear that we're possibly wrong is the Russians certainly were trying to influence that election and put a lot of sophisticated resources behind that effort.
Darren, I want to bring you in here because you've been studying the Internet Research Agency's messaging and tactics for years, and these new reports are basically telling us how this company tried to appeal specifically to African Americans. Can you give us a sense of what they did?
Well, what they've done is really just a continuation of what the KGB did for the Soviet Union in days gone by, back in the 60s and 70s. They tried to influence the civil rights movement then, and they're trying to do very much the same thing today. They see issues like the Black Lives Matter movement as a wedge to both drive Americans farther apart and obviously potentially influence elections.
And what are some of the components of these campaigns? I mean, I'm thinking about folks who are listening to this and saying, did I see one of those ads? What would it have looked like? Where could I have come in contact with this?
Sure. And that's changed a lot through time. My colleague Patrick Warren and I here at Clemson have looked at a lot of tweets, really more than is healthy for any one individual to look at.
I'm sorry. That sounds painful.
Yeah, it's been an ordeal. But their tactics have changed through time. So back during the election, they did things like they had an organization called Black Matters US, and that organization had a website. That website is still live. Your listeners can go there today, blackmattersus.com, and look at it. It hasn't obviously been updated for a while, but it's still up. And that website had Instagram accounts, YouTube videos, as well as obviously Facebook and Twitter. And they tried to organize actual events here in the United States. They even had a podcast. It was very broad-reaching in their approach. But then they also had a lot of accounts that just purported to be normal Americans who were part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And those types of accounts continued right up until this past election. Mike Patrick and I traced a number of them that were active right up into November of this year.
I want to play a clip for you from a press conference held by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein back in February.
The Russians also recruited and paid real Americans to engage in political activities, promote political campaigns, and stage political rallies. The defendants and their co-conspirators pretended to be grassroots activists. According to the indictment, the Americans did not know that they were communicating with Russians.
Darren, how is it possible that we did not know we were dealing with Russians?
Well, they're very good at their job.
Okay.
And frankly, they've gotten better. They have recruited really intelligent group of people that understand social media, that understand the pulse of the United States. And you can see that improve over time. The accounts that we've traced most recently have grown very quickly in the number of followers. I've seen accounts grow from zero followers to 20,000 in just a matter of a few months. One account that we were following, an account called Polite Melanie, even won the Chicago Tribune's Tweet of the Week contest back in September. So to do something like that, you really have to have a sense of American culture and the American mentality. And they do. They've sent people here to do research, and they've recruited people that are fluent English speakers.
Craig, I want to ask you, these reports are not linked to the Russian government specifically, but Rosenstein's July 2018 indictments did charge 12 Russian government agents with meddling in Hillary Clinton's campaign and other Democratic Party organizations. Craig, does this new report give us a better picture of the overall Russian effort?
What these reports show us is, with a degree of completeness and detail we've never had before, is how the disinformation campaign happened. It doesn't get into the question of how the Russians intelligence service hacked into Clinton campaign emails. It doesn't really speak on those matters. What it does is it helps us understand how Russia essentially took control of a massive number of accounts across every social media platform and turned them against American democracy. And so, you know, we've learned things about Instagram and YouTube and Tumblr and Medium and Vine, you name it. There's details in these reports that illuminate how shrewdly the Russians, you know, ran this influence operation. I have to echo Darren's very wise point. Man, they were good. I mean, you read through these tweets and posts and you think, yeah, man, they know us. They know us probably better than we know ourselves in some ways.
And that brings me to the next question, which is, a lot of Americans are using these technology platforms to stay in touch with each other. But what does this latest development, Craig, tell us about our increasingly fraught relationship with big tech companies like Google and Facebook, particularly Congress's relationship with those companies?
I think there's been a lot of signs for a long time now that, for all of the wonderful qualities of social media, that they really open a Pandora's box of garbage into our conversation that probably wouldn't be there without the social media. When you give essentially everybody in the world the opportunity to say whatever they want to anybody they want to, it has unintended consequences. And that's what we're living with today. And while the focus of these reports are what the Russians did, there are disinformation projects happening all over the world, some aimed at the United States, some aimed at people in other countries, but they're global, they're massive. And I frankly find it terrifying. And I actually don't know what to do about it. I mean, so you're right that Congress and the government is focused on this in a way they weren't before. They're skeptical of the tech companies. But you very frequently run into very concrete free speech problems when you try to regulate these things. And so as much as all of us would probably like a kind of like solution to this problem, I honestly don't know what the solution to this problem is, other than all of us individually being somewhat more skeptical of the kind of stuff that rolls through our Facebook and Twitter feeds.
Darren, what about you? Your thoughts on that? I mean, I know there's this term fake news has been tossed around oftentimes inaccurately for real news, but how, you know, what can be done? Whose feet should be at the fire right now in terms of making sure? Is it the tech companies? Is it the U.S. government?
Sure. Well, Craig's right. This is becoming much more of a global issue. We're not the only targets. The very things that we love about America, our openness, our freedom of speech, those are the things that give the Russians an asymmetrical advantage when it comes to disinformation. They can hit us hard with this sort of thing, and well, we can't hit back because they don't have the same freedoms. And the same is true with a lot of other countries that are engaging in this, including Iran. And we've seen disinformation coming out of Saudi Arabia recently with the Khashoggi murders. But what to do is it's hard to know. We would certainly like to see the platforms doing more. They have been doing more in the past year, certainly, but I think they could help us out even more. We haven't seen them very forthcoming, and the report pinpoints this with a lot of information. They would rather this not be a story. I'm sure they would prefer us not having this conversation right now. But they could certainly do more and be more forthcoming. Twitter hasn't released any additional tweets for the past 6 months.
And we've got about a minute left. I'd like to ask both of you quickly for your thoughts. Are we ready for 2020?
No.
Okay. I like that.
Absolutely not. No, we are not ready. And we're not going to be ready. We're going to be living this.
Darren? Yes,
I completely agree. From the Russians' perspective, this is cheap. Their whole program costs less than one U.S. fighter plane. And any response we're going to have is going to be expensive.
Darren Linville is an associate professor at Clemson University. Darren, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And Craig Timberg is a national reporter covering technology for The Washington Post. Thank you, Craig.
It's been my pleasure.
So after learning about the Russian interference in the 2016 election, do you use social media differently?
This is James from Mellick, Oklahoma. I have quit using most forms of social media and have blocked or removed anyone posting any unsupported content. I only use Facebook to see pics of my family.
Hi, this is Amber from Worcester, Mass. And as one of the first college graduates probably that had Facebook in my generation, we learned early on from our parents not to put anything you wouldn't want blasted all over the news on Facebook, social media, and to scrutinize everything that you read, see if it's from an actual legitimate source or if it's made up. I'm just wondering how all these other baby boomers missed that memo.
Thanks, as always, for sharing your thoughts with us on The Takeaway.
Dictator! 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 Dictator!
Thousands of Hungarians have taken to the frigid streets of Budapest over the last 5 days to protest the government of far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. Two new laws incited the protests. Citizens are calling one a slave labor law because it forces employees to work up to 400 hours of overtime a year with delayed payment. The second law establishes a parallel judicial system run by the executive branch of the government. But the protests have grown to represent broader dissatisfaction with the Hungarian government and its attempts to suppress coverage of this uprising. On Monday, four opposition lawmakers were violently thrown out of the state television building for trying to broadcast a petition. Patrick Kingsley has been on the ground reporting on this situation every step of the way, and he's an international correspondent for the New York Times, and he joins us now. Patrick, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So first, can you tell us the two new laws, how did they lead to these protests?
Well, last Wednesday, the government tried to push these through parliament without any debate, and that really angered the opposition MPs in the Hungarian parliament. They tried to stop the passage of those laws, not by voting against them because they don't have a majority, but by essentially civil disobedience inside the parliament, blowing whistles, obstructing the passage to the speaker's chair. And they broadcast this using Facebook Live on their Facebook feeds. And that seemed to ignite something among a few thousand ordinary Hungarians who also don't like what's going on. They were particularly angered by the so-called slave law that increases the amount of overtime each Hungarian worker has to do each year. And that became the initial focus, as you said, of the protests. People came out, protested outside Parliament three nights in a row, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday last week. And it sort of grew and grew. On Sunday, there was a much larger protest of around 15,000 people, some of whom later, in sub-zero conditions, marched through the snow to the state media broadcaster on the edge of town. And some of the people in that march were opposition lawmakers, and they entered the building, as is their right as lawmakers, and tried to get the editors of the state media program to let them on TV to talk about why there was all these protests and to make some demands of the government. They had an all-night standoff starting on Sunday night, ending on Monday morning, and it ended with those lawmakers, or some of them at least, being physically thrown out of the state media headquarters. In one case, carried and thrown out through a side door.
Patrick, what can you tell us about the protesters themselves? Who are they?
Their real range, actually, it's quite striking. You've got people from leftist parties, centrist parties, even a far-right party. It's a real political mix. That's quite unusual, because one reason why Orbán has been so strong over the last 8 years is that the opposition has stayed so fragmented. But we've just seen some shoots of unity in the last week, which has had observers remarking that if this could continue, come the European elections next spring, the elections for the European Parliament.
So how is Orbán's government responding to these growing protests?
They're basically trying to ignore it. That's why the state media, state broadcasters, wouldn't let the opposition lawmakers onto their shows. They are trying to paint them in private media as provocateurs, as foreign agents, agents of George Soros, trying to suggest that these are not actual Hungarians, that these are foreigners who have come to stir up trouble, and that no Hungarian in their right mind would really be opposed to Mr. Orbán.
And yesterday you tweeted that with the assaults of four MPs, the Orbán regime has, quote, crossed a threshold that it previously dared not cross. Can you explain that for us?
Well, I think it's a new moment for Hungary, because for the past 8 years, Viktor Orbán has done many things that you might describe as tinted with authoritarianism, infringing the judicial independence, stacking the constitutional court with his loyalists, gradually taking over both state and private media, and putting his own allies in charge of most of what are supposed to be independent state institutions. What he hasn't done in all these 8 years is do anything that strays into naked displays of violence against his opponent. What we saw on Monday means that we've gone into a different realm now, because we had four opposition lawmakers in slightly different contexts get roughed up, and one of them actually hospitalized. And so that takes us from a slightly intangible sense of authoritarianism into a very egregious display of political violence against the opponents.
And overall, what about Hungary's relationship with the European Union at this point? What's the status there?
Well, over the past 8 years, the commission that runs the European Union has tried various different measures to rein in Viktor Orbán. But ultimately, the EU is not set up to deal with someone like Mr. Orbán, who is trying to sort of rein in Hungarian democracy after the country has already entered the European Union. The Union doesn't have the mechanisms to deal with someone like that. So ultimately, the Commission has been not very effective in dealing with him. A couple of months ago, the European Parliament, which is a separate institution within the European Union, voted to begin a kind of sanctions procedure against Mr. Orbán. But ultimately, that is again another sort of more symbolic gesture than anything else. And so we've been left with a situation where the European Union, which is nominally a union of democracies, faces a country within its midst, Hungary, that has experienced a great degree of democratic backsliding in the last 8 years, and the Union has been unable to do much about it.
Patrick Kingsley is an international correspondent for The New York Times. Patrick, thanks again for your reporting.
Thank you.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
There's another job opening in President Trump's cabinet following the resignation of Secretary of the Interior over the weekend. Ryan Zinke is facing multiple ethics probes connected to real estate dealings in his hometown of Whitefish, Montana, and other conduct while in office. The president says he will announce a new agency head next week, and in the meantime, Deputy Interior Secretary David Bernhardt will step in. But is he there to stay? Coral Davenport is the energy and environment correspondent for The New York Times, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. to discuss the fate of the Department of Interior. Thanks for joining us, Coral.
Sure. Great to be with you.
So who is David Bernhardt, and what do we know about him?
So David Bernhardt is the Deputy Secretary of Interior. He's the number two. He's not at all known as a public figure outside Washington. He was not a member of Congress or governor or anything like that. He was an oil lobbyist. And the role that he has played thus far at the Interior Department is kind of the man behind the curtain who makes things happen. Ryan Zinke was very much a public figure, and he embraced that, and the president embraced it. He rode a horse named Tonto to work on the first day, you know, while wearing a Stetson. He would, you know, do all these big photo ops at national parks. He really kind of embraced the public role of being a Trump cabinet member. But the fact is, Ryan Zinke was not at all known as someone who was particularly smart with policy or had a lot of policy experience. He was, in many ways, the face of the major policy, Trump policies that the Interior Department was implementing, rolling back protections for public lands, shrinking the sizes of national monuments, opening up vast new swaths of land and water to offshore drilling. The person who was making all of that happen, pushing the buttons and pressing the levers, was David Bernhardt. Bernhardt is a former oil lobbyist and lawyer. His clients, former clients, have included major energy companies like Halliburton, lobbying groups like the Independent Petroleum Association of America, which represents hundreds of oil companies. He also was an official in the Interior Department, the Bush administration. So he has been the one, not at all a public figure, but the one who has really been implementing all of these major policies to open up public federal lands for drilling.
So the big question is, of course, the one that I think matters on so many levels here is, what's Bernhardt's relationship with President Trump?
So thus far, you know, Bernhardt has been the guy who gets the job done. He doesn't have these qualities that President Trump often seems to embrace in his cabinet figures. He used to say about Ryan Zinke all the time, "I love that guy. He's from Central Casting." David Bernhardt, if he's from Central Casting for anything, he is Central Casting as an oil lobbyist. He does not have that photogenic flair. He's not particularly charismatic. I would not describe him as an outdoorsman. So he doesn't have all of these kind of superficial qualities that the president really seems to like in his top officials, but he's the guy who gets the job done. And one of the things about the Trump administration is that while so much of it is in total chaos, one area that they really are getting things done is in these pushes to roll back environmental protection and open up areas for new drilling. It's getting done efficiently and quickly. And at least in some ways, it's getting done by a guy who knows what the rules are and is working on getting them to stick legally. All that's David Bernhardt. And that definitely carries weight with the president.
So, Coral, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, no surprises here, raised red flags about Bernhardt back in July of last year when he was up for the position of Deputy Interior Secretary. Take a listen.
Mr. Bernhardt has shown that he is unwilling to fight for the long-term conservation of our public lands and the responsible use of our public resources.
Again, as I said, no surprise that Senator Warren is not a fan of Bernhardt, but are other lawmakers raising concerns at the time?
So there have been concerns raised about David Bernhardt since his confirmation in 2017. And the biggest concern is that the appearance of conflict of interest that he brings to the job. He's a former oil lobbyist, a former lawyer for major oil companies who left that job and went straight into being one of the top officials in the country who regulates the oil industry. And, you know, good government watchdogs have targeted him from the beginning as someone who clearly appears to have a conflict of interest. One of the big policy moves that Bernhardt oversaw was a new plan, a revision of the existing federal plan to protect the habitat of the sage grouse. This is this sort of funny little chicken-like bird that has a vast habitat, tens of millions of acres in the West over oil-rich states, and oil companies have really wanted to be able to drill in some of the sage-grouse habitat. Just recently, a new plan was put forward, authored largely by David Bernhardt, that lifts about 9 million acres of existing protection from that habitat, making it much easier for oil companies to drill, including many of David Bernhardt's former clients who have specifically asked for these policy changes. And the argument of the Interior Department on the question of is that a conflict of interest is that he's not acting directly to benefit his specific clients, that move would benefit hundreds of companies and, in fact, many different industries, not just oil companies. And that's true. And that kind of keeps him following the letter of the law. He would be in violation if he pushed a policy that very precisely and specifically profited one of his former clients. That's kind of the way the law is written. But members of the Senate have looked at this and said, you know, this does not sit well with us. So I do think that while he would have a lot of Republican support, David Bernhardt might be a difficult Senate confirmation.
I'm wondering if that means that Bernhardt, what if he decides not to keep the job or he's fired or something? I mean, is there somebody else in consideration after him, just given the turnover in this administration?
Well, the question is, will he become the next head of the department? If he doesn't, it's very likely that he will just stay right where he is and keep kind of pushing all these policies. But if the White House decides, A, that it would be too difficult for Bernhardt to get confirmed, or B, that they would like another central casting political figure at the head of the agency, which is typically what the Interior Department has, there are a lot of other likely candidates. One of the most frequently named possible candidates is Senator Dean Heller of Nevada. He just lost his election, so he is looking for another job, and he fits the classic profile of a typical interior secretary on both parties. He is a lawmaker from the West. He's a politician, so he's got good hair. He knows how to wear a cowboy boot. Other possibilities are also from Nevada, Governor Brian Sandoval. Really, also, I think that he would be confirmable. I think he would get a good number of Democratic votes as well, so he could have a bipartisan confirmation. The problem with him is that he has publicly criticized President Trump, specifically President Trump's plan to send National Guard troops to the Mexican border. So, you know,
not usually a good thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Would that be a problem for him? But those are two possible candidates who have been named.
Coral Davenport is the energy and environment correspondent for the New York Times. Coral, thanks again.
Tanzina, great to be with you.
The next story is disturbingly familiar, an investigation into a long history of concealed sexual abuse by Catholic priests. Only this time, those who were targeted included women and girls in Native communities in Alaska and Indian reservations across the Northwest. And just a warning, this conversation could be upsetting or inappropriate for some audiences.
I figured that short of intercourse, it was all right. Okay, was there a theological justification in your mind for it? Was there a secular justification? Was there some sort of process you went through where you justified it? How did that work?
I thought I was bringing love into the life of other persons.
By engaging in sexual acts with them?
By being intimate.
And what's your definition of intimacy?
Everything short of intercourse.
That's Jesuit priest James Poole in a 2005 deposition describing how he abused Elsie Boudreau. Elsie is an Alaska native who met Poole when he was based in a small town called St. Mary's. She was just 10 years old at the time. But Boudreau wasn't Poole's only victim. A joint investigation by Northwest News Network and Reveal has uncovered many more accounts of sexual abuse the Catholic Church was aware of. And it's what happened to Poole and others like him after the accusations emerged that's also deeply concerning. He was afforded a safe place to retire on the campus of Gonzaga University in Washington State. Emily Schwing is a correspondent for Northwest News Network, and she joins me now from Spokane Public Radio, not far from Gonzaga, to talk about her reporting on this story. Emily, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we mentioned James Poole. How did you start to report on him?
Sure. So I never actually personally met James Poole while I was working at KNOM, which is the radio station that he founded out in Nome, Alaska. But it's my understanding that he was very charismatic, a very outgoing kind of guy. His abuse came to light in 2003 after Elsie Boudreau filed a civil lawsuit against him and the Jesuits. And then after that, through the discovery in that case, letters started to surface that had been sent about James Poole dating back to 1960 that outlined concerns about his misconduct from church leadership that went all the way to Rome. And then in the 80s, there were a number of women that came forward that had been volunteers at KNOM and nurses in Nome who also accused him of sexual abuse and misconduct.
What was the scale of these accusations?
It's very large. There are more than 300 known childhood victims of clergy sex abuse in Alaska Native villages in Western Alaska alone. There are likely hundreds more victims on Indian reservations in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana.
I want to play you some of your interview with Elsie Boudreau, who we mentioned at the top. This was a victim of James Poole.
The whole premise behind the Catholic Church and their mission with Native people, with Indigenous people, was to strip them of their identity. Sexual abuse was one way.
Emily, can you give us a sense of what Elsie's saying there about the history of the church and Native communities?
Yeah, the Catholic Church sent Jesuit missionaries to Alaska beginning in the late 1880s. Their goal was to Christianize Alaska Native people. There was an influenza outbreak in the early 1900s. In one case in St. Mary's, they built a mission school that was also an orphanage. But unfortunately, the Alaska Native people were not allowed to speak their native languages, practice their own native spirituality, or partake in any of their, you know, cultural events and things like that, or celebrations. And the same went for American Indians who were living on reservations here in the Northwest.
What role does isolation play in enabling these crimes to occur?
It does play a large role, I would say, just because, you know, there's sort of an out of sight, out of mind attitude about this. Once these priests were placed in these villages, they weren't heard from again. The winter is long. There are very few roads down here in Washington State. You know, if you go up to the Spokane Indian Reservation, there's no cell phone service in parts of that reservation. It's the same on the Colville Tribal Reservation as well.
Emily, can you tell us the role that Gonzaga played in all of this, the university?
Yeah, I can. It's actually really important. So Gonzaga University did not make decisions about who was going to live at the campus. There is a retirement home for retired Jesuit priests, and we found that at least 20 retired priests with accusations of sexual abuse lived at this home as far back as 1986. the home is adjacent to the campus. For all intents and purposes, it's pretty much on campus. But Gonzaga was not making decisions about who was living there.
What happens to these accused Jesuit priests, people like James Poole? We heard a little bit of his deposition, but given that these men have all been living in this retirement home, whatever happened to him and what happened to the rest of these abusers?
Nothing. The answer is nothing. They were not tried in a criminal court. They were not charged. They were not prosecuted. And that's for a number of reasons, mostly having to do with the statute of limitations in various states where they had been accused of sexual abuse. So they quietly went to retire at this retirement home at Gonzaga, where they had healthcare services, free tickets to see the basketball, the men's basketball team, the Bulldogs. And they had, you know, free use of the library.
I want to clearly state that we did reach out to the university and have not gotten a comment from them. Have they spoken to you?
I have requested to sit down with the administration and the university president a number of times and have not been met with any sort of answer on whether they'd be willing to do that. They did release a statement late last night at 11:15 Pacific time where President Thane McCullough said that he really regretted hearing this news, that it had reopened old wounds for him in terms of abuses that he had heard about from other Jesuit priests in the past, and that he did not have any knowledge of the men who were living at this home.
We also reached out to the Jesuit order, have not heard from them either. What has been their response to this story?
The Jesuit order put out a new updated list of names of accused priests on December 7th, and they will be undergoing an external review, which they say is due out next spring. They hired a third-party firm to look through their records to find out more. There's no definitive timeline on when that will be out.
Emily Schwing is a correspondent for the Northwest News Network. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
We're just a week away from Christmas, and of all the acts of kindness you've been sharing with us for our series, America the Kind, this next one was pretty big.
Hi, my name is Corrine Taylor. I'm calling from West Bridgewater, Massachusetts, and I'm calling about an act of kindness that was done in my town. It was found that there is a resident that has cancer. She loves Christmas, and it was put out to decorate your house, you know, lights, decorations, and over 50 houses were decorated, and most of these same people who did this did not know her, just thought it was a nice thing to do to brighten someone's day that was really in need of it.
Danette Guthrow was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer in July.
My mom wanted to celebrate while she felt well enough to celebrate and enjoy the kids and the family. She's always loved Christmas. It's always been a big deal in our family.
That's Danette's daughter, Lisa Holden, and she lives close to her mom in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts.
So she decided that she wanted to do it early.
Danette and Lisa had planned to keep their early Christmas to the family. But then the town got wind of what was happening and the celebration grew, eventually involving a toy drive in Danette's honor and a group of carolers organized by neighbor Heather DePalma. So I talked to Heather and Lisa about that night on November 3rd and what it meant for Danette and the whole town. But we start at the beginning of the story. And as Lisa says, the premature holiday celebration began small.
My mom and myself and one neighbor decided we were going to, you know, put up our lights outside so that my mother could enjoy them. And I just let some people in town know that what we were doing so that people didn't think we lost our minds and forgot about Thanksgiving. And pretty soon the town joined in.
And Heather, when did you come into all this? You knew Lisa, but you didn't know her mom.
Correct. Lisa's daughter and my daughter are in third grade together. And so we've chatted, you know, at parent pickup and everything. And Lisa knows that I'm involved with the Girl Scouts in town. I'm a troop leader here. And so she reached out to me early November before Thanksgiving to see if I could gather some Girl Scouts together to do early Christmas caroling for her mom.
This is really, really sweet. I'm thinking about how you made that choice to do that. Tell me about what happened next.
Well, I am a Christmas person as well, so I think we're kind of kindred spirits here. So I kind of went a little nuts crazy, if you will, by involving my brother, who owns a local DJ company. He DJs weddings and things, because I know he had access to a snow machine. So he's my first call. So we got some snow so Danette could experience a little bit more festivities. And then just the town really stepped up around us. A lot of people were contacting me to join the Girl Scouts to carol for Danette. So it was really, really heartwarming to see all these people stepping up, willing to help out.
Lisa, why does your mom love Christmas so much? And what did it mean for her when she saw this?
Well, Christmas has always just been joyful. It's all happiness, it's enjoying the children and the laughing, and it's just magical. So I just figured, like, as a gift, you know, we've never seen carolers before, and we've always talked about that. And she was all smiles all night, and she's still talking about it to this day.
Your mom?
Yeah, it meant the world to her.
Did your mom know that this was happening?
She did not. I just told her that the kids were out in the yard and they had a little surprise for her and they wanted her to come outside. She walked out to over like 100 people in her yard. I don't know how she didn't hear them.
Heather, you must have been good at keeping everybody in line.
So we met at the town hall in town, and then the local school bus company donated a school bus to us for the evening. So that way I could safely get everybody to and from Danette's house. I was really concerned. We had our police involved. They escorted the school bus. Santa Claus was there. They dropped us off at a side street down the road a piece, and then the police blocked their street off so we could kind of parade down, and the police officer actually played Here Comes Santa Claus over his loudspeaker as we were all walking down. The whole community really got together for this. I even had one mom who purchased 30 Santa hats from the store to bring and pass out. And just the look on her face when she saw it was close to 200 people walking through her yard singing Here Comes Santa Claus and yelling Merry Christmas is an image that I will never get out of my head. Just the pure joy on her face. It was just a beautiful thing.
Lisa, how did you feel about that when you saw the community come together?
It was absolutely amazing. Absolutely. They provided memories that we couldn't. Put a smile on mom's face. I can't even describe the feeling that was in the air that night. So much love. And it was literally felt like we were in like a Hallmark movie. I can't even describe how amazing it was.
Heather, did you have any idea when you were getting all these folks together?
I really had I didn't expect to see that many people show up. You know, you put it out there to a group. I asked for RSVPs, but, you know, I really wasn't sure how many people would actually show up that day. And just to see the community come together, we're a pretty small town. So to have almost 200 people show up, that's pretty phenomenal. And it just goes to show the Guthrow family, Lisa and her family, her girls, that, you know, they're not alone in this process. And the family is well supported. And, you know, all of our positive thoughts are going to them and to Danette to help them get through this season and future seasons as time goes on.
Lisa, how do you feel now about the community?
I've always loved the community. And they've always been such a warm community, which is why my mother lived here first. And that's why we decided to move here and have kids here. And they always seem to join in for each other. And this was just absolutely amazing.
What do you think people can take away from this story about kindness, particularly in this moment, Lisa?
Well, in such a sad situation, there's so much joy. My mother smiles every single day, which makes us smile. And then when you smile, you pass it on to somebody else. And you just never know what someone else is going through. So you just smile and always look for something good every day.
Heather, how do we become more kind? You seem to have a good handle on this kindness thing.
Well, I think it's one of the greatest gifts we can give our children is to teach them the true meaning of Christmas and the true meaning of being a community member, the true meaning of taking care of your neighbors and your friends and your family. I got many texts and emails and messages after this event thanking me for helping families show their children what Christmas is all about and what this season is all about. And that I think that's the most important thing, is to pass that on to the next generation so that they can make a difference in this world as well.
And Lisa, I'll leave the final word to you. How do we become more kind?
Just try to smile. Just try to pass it along. It doesn't take a whole lot to make someone else smile. And that can take you very far.
Lisa, Heather, thanks for coming on the show and for sharing your story. And Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
That was Lisa Holden and Heather DePalma of West Bridgewater, Massachusetts. And you're listening to the group of 200 people singing jingle bells to Jeanette in her backyard on the night Christmas came early to West Bridgewater. And you can see pictures of that night and find the rest of our stories from this series at thetakeaway.org/AmericaTheKind. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Wait a minute, is that a new one?